There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be.
No stranger to the show, Lon Safko is back with us. He's the author of the Social Media Bible, Tactics, Tools, Strategy for Business Success. He's an innovator, a professional speaker with over 25 years of experience in entrepreneurship, marketing, sales, strategic partnering, speaking, training, writing, and e-commerce. And he's the founder of 14 successful companies, including Paper Models, Inc., holds 3 patents of internet advertising, has 18 inventions and more than 30,000 personal records as part of the permanent collection of the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. And he is the inventor of the first computer to save a human life. Lon, welcome back. It's been too long.
Hello, Michael. It's good to hear you.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. Pretty excited to be back on the show.
Wonderful. By the way, the thing I had to ask after the intro is, what do you do in your spare time?
Write more books, I guess, and talk to you.
No, I'm fine. Everything is rocking and we're moving. I've got my first book going to be published within a couple, 3 weeks, and we're moving on from that point.
Congratulations.
Yeah, yeah.
No, Long overdue.
It's exciting. It's about communication. But I want to talk about social networking. One of the things that there's this tool, and I have to call it a tool, that's there, and there are so many people who have no concept of how viable it can be.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you call it a tool because, you know, it really is a tool. Social media is medias or tools that we just basically use to be social, to have two-way communication. So it's really cool for connecting with an old high school friend. But it's also really awesome if you have a small, medium, or even a large-size business because it allows you to have that same connection, build that trust, and have that conversation with your prospects and clients.
You know, which is interesting also, there was years and years ago that six degrees of separation, I could get excited about something, Lon, I could tell you about it, you tell 3 people, they tell 5 people, and maybe if we had 100 people that knew about it, that was a lot of people in those days. Today, with one mouse click, you can talk to hundreds of millions of people.
You know, that's absolutely true, and I warn the customers that I work with, the individuals right up to the Fortune 500s, that customer care, customer service is more important today than it's ever been because you've heard the statistics that if a happy customer will tell 7 to 9 people and an unhappy customer used to tell 15 people, but now it's not 15, it's 15,000 or 150,000 with the click of a button, as you said. It's word of mouth at the speed of light.
Yeah, and it's scary. And as a matter of fact, when it's scary, if you don't have a handle on it, it can get out of control. But then there's guys like you around who have a handle on it. So if I need, you can come over and symbolically hold my hands. Don't send flowers, but you can come over, hold my hand, and take me through what I need to do to not only create my own business, but to expand it in such a way to get people to hear about it that would have never heard about it had I not picked up a phone and talked to you.
You know, that's absolutely true. And just like other things that scare us, it really what we're just afraid of is the unknown. A lot of people don't understand what social media is or how to use it for their businesses. So, you know, it's kind of like the monsters in the closet. Once you turn on the light, you see that it's just an old sweaty sweatshirt. It's really not that hard.
No, but the other thing, too, is let's look at what's happened recently. Look at social media. Look at what it did to foreign governments. Look at Egypt. Look at Libya. Look at China. You know, you're standing in the middle of this mass rioting, people getting killed, and you're twittering.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. Twitter has actually saved quite a few people's lives. Also, even in the earthquake in Japan, Twitter was one of the number one tools for helping find trapped victims or knowing where the crews should go to save people. But it is toppling governments, and that's absolutely amazing. I mean, people over in Europe, in Egypt particularly, are crying, "I want my Facebook." And when the government censored it, and when the government censored Google in China, you know, they uproared because they want what I talk about all the time, which is transparency. They want transparency in the government.
Well, transparency is something that most people don't get. But what happens is if you force them, but how do you force them? How do you get the word out? And the word out is through mass, through volume. And that's really what social media has come to. As a matter of fact, I can see that, and I've seen the transition, because, you know, I go back to the days of you had a telephone and a desk, and that's all you had to operate with. But I've seen the transition. It's also affected the culture. It's affected the kids today. We live in a new society and a new way of doing things. And if you're not going to stay abreast of it, you might as well just give it up, because somebody else is going to move so rapidly faster than you are.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And unfortunately, I remember the days when the telephone was really the only technology we had for communicating, that and snail mail, which was completely inefficient. And it really has changed society. And the reason is that, if, for example, in Egypt, no matter how many press releases or news the government sends out to the people in the rest of the world about the way the lifestyle is there, there's people with cell phones, there's people taking pictures, there's people shooting video, there's people posting things to MySpace and Facebook, and they're sending out tweets. So the wonderful thing about social media is the truth is going to come out eventually, and that might hurt some of us, but in the long run, we'll all benefit.
You know, let's talk about this, because I think it's important. I want to go to the book for a minute, The Social Media Bible, Tactics, Tools, Strategies for Business Success. The book is part reference. I have the book, obviously, and I've had it for a long time. Part how-to manual, part business strategy. It's for the big guys. It's for the small guys. And what it really is, it's a very practical, very powerful, very effective way to connect with customers, prospects, employees, stockholders, collaborators. My goodness, there isn't the list doesn't stop, Lon.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And really what we're talking about is building trust. We're building a relationship. I love doing your show because I know you and I trust you and I know who your audience is and I trust you'll do a great show. So we have a great business together. And other people want that same relationship with their companies, with the people who represent their companies. So the first thing you do is you build this trust, because remember, nobody buys something from a corporation. Almost always they buy it from an individual, and that has to be someone that they trust.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, it's that representative of, no one's ever bought from a corporation, no one's ever bought from a business, but it's that person that connect with them. They can connect through communication, they can connect through that experience that they're going to get the absolute best for them with whatever this person does for them, and I think that's the key. And with social media, and especially with the transparency, there's nothing you can't find out about somebody at any time, anywhere, anyhow.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. Before I pick up the phone and I call somebody, I'd look and see their LinkedIn. I want to see their profile. And let's say, for example, they're in Baltimore. So I'll quick type into my cell phone or on the on my desktop, what is the weather in Baltimore? So as soon as I get the person on the phone, we have something in common. We can talk about the weather because I know exactly what's going on. Maybe we went to the same university. Maybe we both have grandkids. Maybe we're into antique cars. So the very first part of the conversation, we instantly build trust, and that's going to help further that business relationship.
Well, that word in and of itself, it really has to be where it is. And I've watched very closely, Lon, over the last 7-8 years especially. We have a brand new customer out there. It's an e-customer. They think different. They feel different. They came from a completely different place than the old customer came from. And it's a customer that, unless you know how to communicate with, how to touch with what you're saying, that you're going to lose that customer to somebody who knows how to communicate. And it is. It's a language. Any way you want to look at it, and it manifests itself through social media. But there is a language to it.
You know, there really is, and that's an amazing observation. So few people actually understand that. One of the things that I had tweeted out about the other day was, is that your website is critical and also irrelevant, which is an oxymoron, obviously. And people asked me, what does that mean? Well, if I have a choice of going to your website and listening to your rhetoric, you tell me why you think you're so good, or I can go to Facebook and actually find 27 people who have done business with you. What do you think has the most value?
Sure. No, I got it loud and clear. And I think really what it really comes down to, you and I haven't talked for a little while, but, I will ask a person, and I'll say, what's your book about? And they'll say, well, it's about this, it's about that, it's about doing this and whatever. And let's try this out. And I'm going to become Lon Safko for a moment, okay?
Sure.
Ask me what my book is about. Go ahead. I'm you now.
Yeah, Michael, what's your new book about?
You.
Ah, I love it. You get right down to the roots. I love it.
But that's really what it is. And if I don't see me within the context of what it is that you're offering, Lon, you in the general sense of the word, you don't have me.
Man, and that's why I love having these conversations, because you always bring it right back to the what's in it for me, and that means me.
Yeah, and realistically, the people that you're trying to reach, anybody you're trying to reach, you're trying to sell to, you're trying to persuade in some way, shape, or form, they don't care about you, they don't care about anybody, but they don't care about you, they don't care about me, they don't care about what you're offering until, here come the magic words, until they understand what you have will benefit them. At that stage of the game, then it all turns around. And by the way, that's the same thing as if you go out and you meet somebody and you want to go out on a first date. What's the benefit? What are you going to make me feel like? Where is it that I'm going to feel good about the decision I made to either ask you out or be asked out or whatever the question is?
And you're absolutely right. It's always about you. It's about what's in it for me. What's my takeaway? Because I don't really care. I don't have time to worry about what's going on in your life. I'm trying to manage my own.
Yeah, and I really believe that when we come down to it, it's the when you take a look at social media, social networking, it's all about, it's the what's in it for me, and the what's in it for me is not a selfish thing. It's how do I become fuller by doing this? How am I able to express myself? How am I able to be heard? Where's my message going to go? And I think that's critical. A message today, no matter where it starts from, no matter where it stems from, it's got to be viral, it's got to be contagious, and somebody has got to tell somebody who's got to tell somebody. Then you've got a message that's understandable.
Well, just what we're doing here. Look how many people you're reaching out to tonight.
Absolutely, absolutely. Oh, you just signed an agreement with PBS Television. You're going to produce the very first TV show on social media.
Thank you. Yes, I did. I'm really proud of that. PBS approached me and asked me if I would do a television show about social media. And I just have to find one sponsor, and we're ready to hit production. I got the best executive producer in the industry. The script is already written. We're ready to go.
Oh, by the way, how do we get a hold of you if somebody likes the idea and wants to jump on board?
Yeah, come on over. It's real simple. LonSafko.com. LonSafko.com.
Okay, LonSafko.com. Now, Facebook we know is very powerful. Twitter is very powerful. And you said Facebook just had 640 million members. I lost this. There was a big something about Facebook. The guys were going to sell it. Did they end up selling it?
Not to my knowledge. I haven't seen anything. There's a lot of offers, but, it's in the billions with a B at this point. I mean, they're estimating that it's worth well over $6 billion. And I don't really see a lot of upside to selling it. Mark Zuckerberg's got all the money that he needs for quite a while, and the development is going along really well.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. One more thing, and then we're going to start to run out of time. Very important, privacy issues. Privacy issues still scare people, the networkers. What do we deal with? Let's define what a privacy issue is.
Yeah, I hear that all the time, everything from individuals all the way up to corporations. People are afraid that there's going to be information that they put into the Facebook or MySpace or the social networks that eventually is going to come out. Yes, that's absolutely true. Anything you put on the Internet could be made public. So, I've been on the Internet since 1994, If you Google me, there's 141,000 web pages that talk about me. But you won't find my wife's name. You won't find my kid's name. You won't even find my home address, because I'm very cautious about what I put on the internet. So if you want to protect yourself, use a little bit of common sense and don't put anything in Facebook that you wouldn't put on a business card.
Oh, that's interesting. I better stop putting Radio Susie's home phone number on the website. No good. I just got a computer thrown at me. Now, okay, so when it really comes down to it, it's called just use your common sense.
Absolutely.
Okay, Lon, one more time. Website we can find you at?
Absolutely. LonSafco.com.
Okay, it's Lon, L-O-N, Safco, S-A-F. How do you spell that?
S-A-F-K-O.
S-A-F-K-O. How do you like the mileage we got on that one?
That was awesome, man. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. Lon, thank you so much, and we'll be looking forward to seeing you again real quick.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. Joseph Cordell. Joe Cordell's with us. He's the author of the 10 mistakes men make. And he's an attorney, and he warns men about the 10 stupidest missteps in divorce. You got to love every second of that. He's the founder with his wife, Cordell and Cordell, the nation's largest law firm focusing on men's divorce. He created the popular website, dadsdivorce.com, for men facing divorce. Again, the 10 stupidest mistakes men make when facing divorce. Joe, hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, divorce, for some reason, it's probably one of the most used things in the country right now. I think the last time I heard the stats, and stop me if I'm wrong, first marriages end up with 55, 60% divorced in the first year or two.
Yeah, it's the statistics are a little unclear, but it's somewhere in the range between 50 and 60% on the divorce rate.
What do you think causes that?
Well, you know, there are a variety of things you can look to, not the least of which is no-fault divorce. It encourages this sort of swinging door approach to marriage.
Okay, now, one of the stats, and this is from your press release, you got over 500,000 men are going to face divorce. Most of them make at least, they're going to irreversible. They make mistakes. They really louse things up. And I know a big mistake I made when I got divorced was I said, oh, here, take everything. It's yours. Wrong move. Okay. But the point is they make some dumb mistakes.
They do. And interestingly, it is that this is an area where men can least afford to make mistakes because they're in a court system, which in many cases is tilted slightly in some cases, more than slightly in others, against them. And as a result, it's critical that if they're going to achieve their goals, that they perform their best, that they expend a little more effort, be a little more assertive, a little more careful than their opponent. And unfortunately, guys instead sort of swagger into the divorce court, either that or they go into the divorce court with the other scenario where they simply have thrown their hands up and thrown themselves more or less to the mercy of the opposing party, in which rarely is there is any. So guys need a book that calls their attention to perhaps the 10 most common serious mistakes that guys make when facing divorce.
Well, one of the things, Joe, and I think this is interesting, that the courts have been, and I don't know if it still runs true today, but the courts have always been prone to the woman. Prone to the woman because the woman's going to get the kids and so on and so forth, which is not always the case today. So effectively, is this what a guy's going up against if he's going to go into a divorce? You got the wife coming after him, and you've also got the judge that's going to come after him also. How do you maneuver around the judge? How do you become equal in that place of divorce?
Well, you know, I think that it's going to be difficult to change societal attitudes and much less to change the legal system in a short period of time. So Cordell and Cordell, our focus and my focus in the book is to try to think about, well, how do we deal with this from a practical standpoint, which comes to your question. You know, who are the parties that guys have to get the attention of, the participants that can change their outcome? Well, obviously the judge. But I'm reluctant to pin this simply on judges who are not fair. I think that increasingly judges are starting to think very fairly about it, and in some jurisdictions they're quite fair, but that's not the majority. The majority is a situation where the entire system has a mindset that's contrary to the dad's best interest or that is favoring the mother. And that includes social workers, psychologists, opposing counsel, legislatures to some extent, but even the attorneys themselves, many of whom, of course, represent men, they themselves find themselves throwing up their hands and deciding at some point in their career that they're not going to swim upstream, that it requires far less effort, and perhaps more excusably, they might be thinking that it's pointless, that guys will spend money and get nowhere. So you have attorneys who are coming in representing guys who are just very passive. I mean, they've resigned themselves to what they think is going to happen to their client. They tell their clients that they need to resign themselves to that.
So a lot of it has reversed itself. You know, there's many times in the long run, it's the substance of what we're dealing with, and it matters more than the process does. And I think what's happened is the process has outweighed itself in value over the substance, and the process is more important, and there's a lot of men who have fell through the cracks because of this and ended up on the wrong end of it. I still say to this day, if a guy's got a couple of kids, and he should be there to support and to help as much as he can, but at the same time, once somebody's gone through a divorce and there's child support involved and so on and so forth, and they take whatever percentage that they take away from the guys, how do they go on to another life? And I think part of the divorce process is getting yourself restructured and not make the mistake the second time around. And the problem, I think, Joe, is there's not only one, but two and three and four divorces along the way until they get to a point of what's going to work anymore in today's culture and society.
Yeah, there are those guys who are kind of repeat offenders, so to speak. I mean, guys who just exercise poor judgment, it can certainly happen to any of us in one marriage, but I really wonder about clients who it's their second, third, or fourth divorce. And at some point, guys have to quit choosing women that are bad candidates for wives. And often, clients will be sitting in my office saying, can you believe this woman, what she's done? And I can't. I mean, I find it incredible. But equally incredible, I'm thinking, you know, this woman probably didn't transform from an attractive, desirable young lady into this overnight, and there probably were seeds of that in the early relationship. So one way to address this problem is for guys to be much more careful early in the process about the decision of marriage, and And that means more often than not waiting until you're older to get married. I tell my daughters who are 13 and 15, I'm already conditioning them, telling them that they don't think about divorce until, or about marriage until they're 30. And I think that the statistics bear out that if people wait, they're more likely to make a better decision. And it does mean that guys have to be more responsible, too, when they get into the divorce process.
Oh, sure. There's got to be a model to follow. And the way that you get the model is not going out there and falling down and thinking that you've learned lessons and it's going to be different next time. The way to get the model, and I really, I'm almost at that point of believing that if you're going to get married, you get a marriage license, that you got to go through some kind of a course that says, this is what marriage is. This is what the responsibilities are, and on and on. So there's a model. And I also believe if somebody's thinking about divorce, before they even go through the actual process itself, find the model, create the model. Sit down with somebody like yourself who have seen the good, bad, and the indifferent when it comes to divorces, and decide what you're going to do and the best way to do it. I think somebody gets mad at somebody, they decide they want a divorce, and then the anger starts, and every attorney that I've known, colleagues, friends, people I've interviewed say the same thing. If you put your emotion into the divorce, it's going to cost you more money than it should.
Yeah, and the challenge is, of course, divorcing, pardon the word, but divorcing from the process, all this maelstrom of emotion. If divorce could be approached from a business standpoint in which the guy, at least, and preferably both parties, are thinking, you know, in very pragmatic terms, then I think that sure, the conflict would be far less, and presumably guys would end up with better outcomes. But the fact is that it's hard to get either side of the table to approach the process that way, and particularly the side of the table, incidentally, Michael, who's being left. I mean, the notion that divorces are truly a joint decision is a bit of a myth. I mean, it happens, but it happens in such a small percentage of the cases.
Sure.
The vast majority of cases involve somebody who's decided they want to move on, usually because they've met someone else, and then the other person who's being left. Well, the person who's being left is far less inclined to grease the skids of the process and to think in an entirely dispassionate way about what's happening around them, to them.
Sure, you're talking about revenge, and that's really what it is. And the resolve is not about having revenge against that person, turning the kids against that person. It doesn't matter if it's the man or the woman. So when the emotions get involved in it, then the problems start, the games start, and you don't really get what you want. Let's move to something else. Let's move to something called a prenup, the prenuptial agreement. Joe, are those good things for people to sit down and discuss before they even get married?
Yes, certainly they are. They've never really gained a lot of momentum in our culture among those that are below the very upper echelons. Now, you do find them gaining a popularity among older middle-class Americans. But I think that it's going to be difficult to sell it to the under 30s who get married at a time when they have no assets. And quite frankly, they may not be confident that they're ever going to have assets. They don't have children. And under those circumstances, they're thinking that, you know, this prenup is addressing something that is entirely speculative. So it's a really hard sell. And those, unfortunately, are the cases where it can become most expensive and most ugly when the parties are 40 years old, 15-year marriage, they have minor children, everything they own is marital, you know, businesses that have been built, retirement plans, etc. Then, of course, they're thinking, you know, it may have made sense to do that, but you know, the cow's out of the barn. But I do think that it's easy to persuade people who have property, they've been divorced, to definitely do the prenup the next go around.
Now, by the way, I've been married and divorced, and I'm going to go out and get a T-shirt. I'm going to get entrepreneur T-shirts for every guy who's been divorced. And I think what we're going to say on it after listening to everything you're saying, it's no place for amateurs.
Oh, there's some truth to that. But you know, other people, I mean, how many people do you know who've gotten a prenup except the wealthy or the the older people who are working, their families are grown and they have children and grandchildren.
Yeah. And by the way, in a monetary measurement, it really doesn't establish what that marriage meant. And there are so many people, and it's very hard. I'm quite confident that when I got divorced, we were still friends today. It was, almost 10 years ago. And we're still friends today. Everything's fine. She's remarried. We talk. But the point of contention is that when you do get divorced, it's very hard to go to the table values neutral and create from there. Someone, and we've touched on this, someone is going to want to get the other guy, quote unquote. And there's where the problem is. And that's why I think that people should sit down with somebody before they decide to get divorced and run through it. And this is the consequence if you do that. This is the consequence if you do this. And they may just realize that some of the steps that they take and the mistakes that they make can be avoided, and the consequence for making the mistakes are worse than sitting down and listening and coming in with some logic.
Yes, I agree with approaching it with some efforts from that end, and then on the opposing end, I think that it makes sense, Michael, to think about treating the marital contract as a real contract. And when you breach a contract, and particularly one so solemnly entered into, I mean, a promise before, you know, God, family, and friends that this is a lifetime decision, then if that person is making the decision that they want to breach the contract to move on, then it shouldn't be no fault. There should be a penalty clause. The other party who has experienced, without question, damages that have resulted from the breach, then I think that they should be able to recover those. And that would make people, number one, pause a little longer, perhaps, before they run into a marriage. And number two, it would make them pause before they run out of a marriage.
Now, by the way, a good point here. Let's go for some words that are operative here. It's a contract, and a contract is a binding something, and it's like going into business. If you were going to go into business with somebody and there was going to be a share or split of money, you're not going to go in on a handshake anymore. You're going to contract. You're going to have a contract, and it's going to spell certain things out. I think the problem with the marriage contract, it is a contract. It's legal. It's binding, but it doesn't spell anything out. It doesn't tell you how you have to be, and if you do certain things, it's dissolved, you're out, and you're gone. And maybe if it was treated more like a business contract, it would be easier to move once the two decide they don't want to be with each other anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right, and it makes sense that it would be treated that way. The single largest business transaction that most human beings will go through, at least in America, is their marriage vows. Because what that does is it encompasses all of not only that they presently possess, although they can potentially treat that as separate, but it picks up every additional dollar that they make going forward. And it's a huge deal that interestingly enough, people who are far more careful about decisions they make routinely about, you know, the purchase of a piece of real estate, a house, or investment decisions regarding the 401k, not to mention the ways in which they strategize and build their business. And yet they go into this marriage as if it's not the gravest financial decision they'll ever make.
Well, by the way, when we talk about decisions and going into contract, I was thinking about this as you were talking. And as an attorney, if you sat down and you worked with a business, you'd create a contract. Now, there's two pieces of a contract. There's the express, which you write down, and this is how you do, but there's also the implied. And I think it's the implied that gets missed. If I'm standing there in front of a group of people and I'm getting married and I say, I promise to love you and vow to do this, 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 and that, and whatever, that's a contract. It is an implied contract, even though you didn't write it down. And I really, truly believe if somebody took somebody to court and said, this is what you said, this is what you promised, based on that, this is what my gain or my losses were, and there could be some effect of that.
Yeah. And at a minimum, we know that there's a breach of their decision to get divorced. And so we know that there was a pledge made that they would love, honor, cherish, you know, yeah, so long as either of them shall live. And so I think that if we reverted back to a system that, quite frankly, was in place for hundreds of years before, I mean, this is not new. What's new is a no-fault divorce, which is a product of the late 60s. There was a, I guess it was kind of a part of the women's liberation movement that felt that it was in women's interest to do this, and I disagree. I think it's disserved men and women, the no-fault divorce. It may have disserved men more. We could argue about that. But it should be something that everybody can agree that it's not been in the interest of our country or the participants.
Yeah, no, and I love it. And when you really come down to it, and I'm going to go back to where I was a little while ago, if we leave the gotchas at the door and we sit down and we're there to construct, and if we construct and we start it from the beginning, you had a contract. Now that contract is void. We want it void, so we're going to recreate another contract. And a divorce, I guess, Joe, when you come down to it, and I hadn't thought about it this way, but a divorce is also another contract, isn't it?
Of sorts. Yeah, it's yeah. It can be. If it's a settlement agreement, yes, it can be a contract.
Yeah. That's it. Thanks. After the show, I'm never getting married again. I don't want to go through it.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah. Oh, no, by the way, no, it's wonderful. Let me ask you this now. From my experience and all the years, that attorneys can only do business in the states that they are licensed to do business in. What if somebody's listening to the show, they're not in the state, but they've heard and they like what you had to say, Joe Cordell, and they want more information? What do we do? How do we do it to get a hold of you?
Well, the Cordell & Cordell is a firm that is national, meaning we're in 20-plus states, and
okay.
we have attorneys that practice law in many states. So they're welcome to look us up online at CordellCordell.com. I can tell you a wonderful website is DadsDivorce.com, where our lawyers have contributed over the years, I'm sure, 1,000-plus articles that are all, it's all free, and it's all incredibly helpful. So those two things I've mentioned, and then, of course, the book that just came out is The 10 Stupidest Mistakes Men Make When Facing Divorce in bookstores across America. But if someone wants to get it more quickly, I would suggest consider ordering it from Amazon or one of the online sources. And for guys, I would suggest in particular think about a digital version so you don't have this hardback book lying around the house.
Yeah, I had to think about that one. She comes
yeah,
up.
Yeah, that can be difficult to explain.
Oh, there's the problems. Hey, Joe, thank you so much for joining us. I thought that was great. Take
thank
care.
Thank you, Michael. Take care.
Good night.
Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening. It's good if I talk with the microphone turned on. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Your love numbers. That's the way it is, which originally published in as The 5-Minute Lover, Your Love Numbers. Richard King with us, an intense interest in understanding the mysteries of life and a desire to know and understand the whys and the wherefores of our existence led Richard to study the ancient metaphysical science and art of numerology, exploring, discovering, and validating theories which explains life's mysteries and life's secrets. His research experience and interest in this ancient science and art led him to design and formulate the King's Numerology. It's a revolutionary numerology system of defining, describing, and interpreting those energies and forces which comprise our lives and our destinies. Numerologist, author, martial artist, and poet, let us say, Richard King, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Nice to be here.
Oh, thank you. I like the martial arts part. If they disagree with you, you get them.
No, not really.
Okay. Okay.
We'll
now, by the way, martial arts in and of itself, if you're going to get into metaphysics and you're going to get into anything really intense, I think martial arts is one of the greatest disciplines that you could ever get. 100 years ago, I got very involved in Sansu in the Los Angeles area, and it was one of the most wonderful things that I had done. I did different styles over my lifetime. But this one was very special. The instructor was great, and all the guys and the women that were there were wonderful, too. That said, let's go to numerology. Richard, what is it about numbers that are so critical to the way we live our life and how we are and our attitudes in life?
I think the answer to that is one that you had talked about with Bob Summers. I listened to your interview with him, sure. And you were talking about love between people, and your point of view was, and I agree with it, when you talk to people, you should say, rather than, I'm in love with you, but rather, I'm in pattern with you.
Yeah.
And numerology is, in the book I published, Your Love Numbers, which is available at yourlovenumbers.com, is a technique that shows you how to translate your name and birth date to numbers and those numerical patterns and how those blend with other people in relationship. It's just okay. Like everything in life is based in numbers, correct? Pythagoras said numbers rule the universe. Everything is arranged according to number and mathematical shape. That goes for light, it goes for sound, it goes for music. Everything, even our lives, our destinies, and our relationships can be determined by numbers. This is what I've spent the last 32 years of my life studying.
Oh, by the way, I happen to be on your side of the table with, okay, let's do this. Let's get real personal with this. I'm going to give you my date of birth, but you got to promise not to tell anybody what year I'm going to tell you.
You're going to have me do it. What would you like me to do in like a couple seconds here? Because it would invalidate.
Okay.
I think I'm kind of.
My date of birth is 11/14/1942.
Hang on one second. Let me do some quick calculations here. Let me have your. Well, we know.
No, go ahead. I'm totally open with anything. Go ahead. I was born in Chicago, Illinois.
Okay. What was your month of birth again, now, Michael?
Okay, it was November 14th, 1942.
Okay.
It's the 42 you can't tell anybody about.
Okay, November 14th, 1942, Michael Ray Dresser, D-R-E-S-S-E-R, correct?
Yeah, Michael Ray Dresser. And I was born in Chicago, Illinois, at 5:08 a.m.
What would you like me to know? What would you like me to tell you?
Anything.
All right, the first thing I usually do is look at a person's soul number. That comes from the vowels in your name. That is the driving, motivating force of every one of us. If that number is not fulfilled in your life, then the person will be unhappy. It has nothing to do with a spouse or how good or decent a person is, but it's whether that energy is fulfilled. Your soul is a 33-6. Now, the 33 has to do with communication. It has to do with self-expression and any kind of media. That six energy, which is its crown, when we add three and three together, we get six. That six is all about love and nurturing of other people. You also have a material soul, which is a second layer, which is about relationship and its relationship with the public. You have a 92 root in that. So the core of who you are is to do really exactly what you're doing, is to be a loving person, to be a relationship-oriented person, and to help and nurture other people in partnership.
Now, by the way, that happens every day in an interview, because one of the most important things is to create that person's core message. I can't tell you how many people get on the air, and I've been at this, it's my 28th year now, both sides of the microphone. And usually what will happen is people haven't really gotten into their true core, and somebody out there misses it. And I think that's really what it is. It's about moving to the soul of the, not necessarily the person, but the soul of the issue at hand, which is really the person, because it's nothing more than an external expression of who you are internally, no matter what you do.
That's correct. And in my work, what I try to do is help people understand, show them the links, the patterns that make for excellent relationships, because some patterns do not make for great relationships. And I mentioned this in the book and in also the course, the Your Love Numbers home study course. Very important.
Don't gloss over that. Okay. I think that's important. What's in the home study course?
The home study course is a digital course, $48, very reasonably priced, price of basically movie out with somebody. I want to keep it reasonable. It contains the Your Love Numbers book in digital format, a PDF. It contains a workbook of 167 pages, also in digital format. It contains several bonus features in there that I give people to make their work easier for them. And also there's another book called Great Love Poems for the Ages, which I compiled from Shakespeare and those kinds of things. I was an English major in school. I think they're important. So you get all of that for $48. Now, you can buy the book on Amazon for $23.98 under my Richard Andrew King author site. But why do that when just for a few more bucks you can get the entire home study course? And on my website, yourlovenumbers.com, you can read about the PhDs, the therapists, and other people who have purchased that who have supported and endorsed the work.
Now, by the way, one of the very important things, you said something about relationship. So let's say I meet somebody, I find out what her numbers are based on her numbers and her life path, etc., that there are numbers that work together, some numbers don't. So is
absolutely.
That okay? So is that?
You,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
What I do in the book is show you the formulas that I have discovered through my research of the last 30 years that make for good relationships. I got into this, Michael, because of a divorce, and I wanted to find out what the secrets were to making good relationships, and so I began asking people if they knew of someone who had been married at least 10 years and if they had had a marriage that was rated a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. In the course of 3.5 years, I found 21 of those couples. I would call them, explain who I was, explain what I was doing, and ask them if I could do their charts. Well, after the third couple, I started seeing the same patterns emerge, the same numerical patterns of all these great relationships. And after 21 relationships, several years later, I finally decided I needed to put this information on down and share it with people, because it is really profound and will change people's lives without question.
And everything is great until, Richard, until Mercury goes into retrograde.
Well, that can be, but what happens, Michael, is when people have enough numbers between them, enough numeric energy, that's glue. And when that glue is strong enough, then when we have Mercury retrogrades and those things, we do not have the kinds of problems that other people would have. These relationships that are very good do not have the kind of angst that a lot of relationships do. There are two numbers that show up in the mix between people that almost invariably cause problems. I tell people about that in the book, and I show them the two secret links that really make people happy. And if those links are fulfilled, then that relationship is going to be a good relationship. If they're not, regardless of how good or decent or pure the people are, their relationship is not going to work. It's all about numerical resonance. And that's from just a person's name and birth date and the other person's name and birth date.
Now, I want to talk about, which I think is the Mercury in retrograde. Richard, I used to take it very lightly about Mercury in retrograde. Then I started noticing that at just about the time it would go into retrograde, I talked to people, their computers were out. I talked to people and their sound systems were out. And all of a sudden, all of these electrical things are happening to everybody, and it cannot just be coincidence. And it seems as though when Mercury goes into retrograde, and I'm not a numerologist, so stop me if I'm wrong here, everything seems to slow down.
Well, in my experience, Michael, the same thing is true. I have noticed that. I've been keeping records of that. And Mercury, of course, is a planet of movement. Now, one thing that you have in your chart is a five life path. I have a five life path, and Mercury is controlled by the number five because it's movement. So I have a theory that people like us who have five in their charts may be affected more by Mercury retrogrades than other people. But absolutely, things go crazy during Mercury retrogrades. People should know when those are, make note of them, and be patient. But it's usually always a communication issue, an electrical, a circulation or circuitry issue, like in computers or cars, that are manifested most through a Mercury retrograde, in my experience, and you have corroborated that through your own as well.
By the way, Richard, when Mercury goes into retrograde, isn't it a time also, and please stop me again, I'm not an expert in this, but isn't it a time also that it's to take a look at yourself? If something's going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong in Mercury in retrograde, and if it goes wrong, if you just sit back, take a look at what's going off, what's off kilter in your life, it's time to fix it. If you're moving through it and it's comfortable for you and you see what things are, you get through Mercury. If you don't, it's going to slam you. Am I close here?
Well, you'd have to talk to an astrologer for sure. I'm not an astrologer, Michael. I'm a numerologist, and I can only speak from my direct experience. But I do believe that at any time in a person's life, we should always be evaluating the things that go wrong to see what we could have done right. So whether an astrologer would tell you what you just said and corroborate that, I don't know. I just am always trying to fix myself. As one saint says, we don't see things the way they are. We see things the way we are. And when we understand our numbers and somebody else's numbers, we can relate our lives better to them, whether it's our spouse, our children, our boss, our coworkers, our partners. And that's the beautiful thing about numerology and the work that I do. Once you understand somebody else, you could manage that relationship so much easier because you're not walking blind. And you can do this in just a matter of a few minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, once you understand the process. Very easy, very simple. And I lay it out very nicely for you in the book and also in the workbook in that program.
Now, by the way, Richard, everything in and of itself is a relationship. You have a relationship with another person, whether they're close to you, whether they're family, whether they're not family. You have a relationship with your business, with all things. It has all got to do with relationship. So let's say somebody decided that we're going to go into business for themselves first time out, or maybe it's not the first time out. Would it be wise to sit down with you and say, this is the business, this is the date we signed the contract, these are the people I'm going to be involved with? Does that give us a leg up on it?
Absolutely. And I've had businesses with partners, and to my chagrin, I did not do the numbers beforehand. I do my relationship charts with people I'm close to, especially my children. I helped raise my children with a knowledge of their numbers. And yes, consult with me before you do that, because we transit, our lives transit energy patterns sometimes that are temporal, they're short-lived. But if there is a long-standing energetic connection, that's what you're looking for. And you can see the problems that clearly show up and who's going to be the manager and maybe who's not. Who's the person that should be talking to the public? Who's the person that should be doing the book work? All of those things are readily accessible in somebody's numbers, actually.
So a good point. So you can get somebody, let's say you've got a business, you've hired a few people, and there's one, let's say the bookkeeper, just to pick a job and a title. And the bookkeeper's not really doing the job the bookkeeper should be doing. And if we took a look at the date of birth and we went through the process, we might find that the bookkeeper is not best in that business, but she could or he could be the greatest marketer in the world. So we take him when we put him over here, and all of a sudden, the business is booming.
That's correct. You would want to look not just at the birth date, but the full name at birth, too. It all works together. And in bookkeepers, accountants, and CPAs, the numbers 4 and 7 are very popular among that group if they're good. If a person had no 4s or 7s and there weren't any in what we call their basic matrix, then that would not be the kind of job they would be suited for. Maybe they have a lot of 3, 5, and 8 energy. That would make them very public-oriented and help them to be excellent salespeople because they would like to be constantly on the move. They would be communicating with people. The last thing you want to do is take somebody who has a 3, 5, and 8 numerical pattern and stick them in a room and tell them to be a book worker because they're going to be very unhappy there. And please remember, getting back to that soul number, Michael, if that soul number is suppressed or covered up and not allowed to have some kind of outer expression, that person is going to be very unhappy, and then you're going to have an unhappy employee. So by knowing people's numbers, whether it's in a business relationship or a marital relationship, a familial relationship such as the family and so forth, we can, again, manage these people's, manage our relationships better from both ends. And I encourage married partners, for example, here's a perfect example. The number 7, when it's in a soul position, that's the desire, needs, wants position of a chart, must have isolation and solitude from time to time. And when a partner doesn't understand that their partner has the 7 energy and that they need space, then they will create problems. But if one partner understood that the other partner needed their space from time to time to recharge, then they could manage it, it being the relationship, much better. They would understand the person, and everybody can work together. And this is, by the way, the age of others, the age of relationship, and I explain this in my book, The Age of the Female. This entire millennium is geared now to the number 2, which is the relationship energy, the energy of others, of females, and that sort of thing. We're past the energy of the 1, which was the male, which was the last 1,000 years. So now it's all about teamwork. It's all about social media, which we're getting into. It's all about relationship and others, not ourselves. If ourselves get too involved in it, as it can happen, then we start having problems. But the higher end of the 2 is balance and harmony between people and teamwork. That's what we should really be working for in this particular millennium.
Okay, now we've got about 2 minutes to go before the segment's up. Let me ask you this. I know that my soul urge is an 8, my life path is a 5. Now, the question is, aren't there numbers that are challenges to those numbers? And I don't speak from experience. For some reason, in the last couple of weeks, the number 7 keeps popping up for me.
Well, let me correct you if I may. From my system, I'm looking at Michael, MichaelRayDresser, correct?
Yeah.
That makes your soul urge a 6, a 33-6, which is not a, your expression from your life path and or your the role in your life is an 8, and that is all about connection with the public and interaction, being on the social stage and that sort of thing.
So actually, then the life path is not a 5, it's an 8.
No, your life path is a 5, your name is a 3, and the performance you will give in life, what we call your PE, is an 8. So life path 5, expression 3, the performance you will give is an 8, your soul is a 6, your material soul is a 2, your nature is a 6 as well, and your material nature is a 2. So there's a lot of nurturing, partnership, teamwork, supportive energy in your chart. Now, you're asking about the number 7?
Yeah. Where does the 7 come from?
No, in your chart?
Yeah. Or somewhere, for some reason.
Well, in your chart, you have it as the core of your life path. You have a 5 life path, which I do, and the centermost part of that life path is a 7, as it is mine. So that's all about analysis, thinking, acting internally. So this 5 energy is going to put you in a mental, spiritual, metaphysical core that's going to move you. Just like our Earth has a core, and the core of your life is a 7, which is all things internal.
Oh,
your expression is an 8. Your expression is an 8, your outward path. So you have sometimes a push-me-pull-you, a tug-of-war between your life maybe pulling you in to be analytical and your external life taking you outside to be more connective socially. The positive part of that is that you get to understand both parts of that world.
And it's necessary. And by the way, Richard, we're just about out of time. Again, your website, we can find you at.
My website, this particular website to this show, is yourlovenumbers.com.
Wonderful. Yourlovenumbers.com. Richard Kings, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate you having me on.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet
not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Skip McGrath with us. He's co-authored How to Make Money Blogging from Home. He started his online career in 1999. He was selling on eBay, and then he quickly became an eBay power seller. And within a few years, he was earning enough on eBay to quit his full-time job as an international marketing executive for a Fortune 100 company in Seattle. In 2000, Skip wrote his first book, The eBay Power Seller Manual, a how-to guide for selling on eBay. And he's since written 14 additional books on eBay, Amazon, internet marketing, affiliate marketing, and blogging. And let us say, Skip, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, good to be on. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we look at it today, the world is completely different in the way sales are made and marketing is made. And if somebody is not abreast of the market of the market du jour, let's say it that way, the marketing of the day, and it could change drastically in a year from now. But for the most part, the internet and marketing and selling, it is so critical to have a base understanding, isn't it, Skip?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, this was something I just sort of fell into. I have to admit, I'm not a very high-tech person. You might think that sounds strange coming from someone who's been making their living on the internet for the last 11 years, but I'm probably just someone that has average computer skills, but the internet is just so intuitive and easy to learn, and I guess what I discovered over the years, there's just so many ways to make money on it if you just open your mind a bit and listen and looked around and played with things and did a lot of experimenting. I have to tell you about, you know, how many times I tried things that didn't work.
No, I got you. By the way, loud and clear, and Skip, when I'm saying it is so different today, I go back to, you know, the tools you had to work with was a wooden desk and a telephone, and that was the end of it. But there is a brand new generation of consumer, and it's the net generation, and it's the first generation to grow up in a digital technology globally, where you got billions of people, not just those, you know, a couple of hundred. So it takes co-creation, and it takes a marketplace now, which that marketplace in and of itself is being transformed. You and I don't really have to be techie, but if you've got a base idea, some critical thinking, and know what kind of a consumer you're dealing with, my goodness, the sky's the limit.
Oh, absolutely. And what you mentioned about worldwide is interesting because this book on blogging that I co-authored with my webmaster, Marcia Perry, is already been translated into Hebrew, and I just got an email from someone in Germany who wants to publish it in German. So this is something that you can do worldwide and in any language. And I know our business, our eBay business, is a worldwide business. I mean, I can't believe where I get orders from. I've sold stuff to Japan and Poland and Lithuania, and I can't even remember the names of the countries. It's absolutely a worldwide. The internet's a worldwide phenomena, and the business on the internet and the opportunities to find fulfillment, whether it's monetary fulfillment, you know, if you're trying to make money, or if you're just trying to use the internet as a place to learn and meet people and communicate with others and, you know, enrich yourselves, it's absolutely international.
Yeah. Now, by the way, when we're really dealing with it, and I want to touch on this, and we'll go to blogging. But the marketplace today, it's transformed by this new generation. And when you really, really think about it, that transparency in and of itself, you and I can Google, we can find out anything we want to find out. But there's a new force in economics, and that force shifts the power towards the customer. And I think that's really where it is. So when you set up and you begin to blog and you begin to do these things, it's just to have this base knowledge in the back of your head when you start doing it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the internet has made business so much more customer focused. I remember, you know, I had a career, long career in marketing and sales in the, in the offline corporate world. And, you know, customer service was always something we talked about, we strived for, we tried to find ways to do it. But the level of customer service that you could deliver on the internet is just infinitely greater than anything we were able to do in the traditional offline world.
Oh, no question about it. Now, blogging has become so critical. There was a time when somebody would, okay, you'd blog. It was like your web writing. And then all of a sudden, somehow it took off, and people are making money blogging. Blogging is critical today, and you don't have to be this, you know, a phenomenal expert in the particular field as long as it catches. And one of the things that you're talking about in the book, which is so true, and I think it's critically important to put this out, that almost anybody can blog, can't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, all you need is an interest in something or a knowledge about something and, just something out there you like. And you don't even have to be a writer. There is tons of free content, and you can even get your blog readers to create content for you, you know, through the comments streams and by having, posts that generate people's ideas. You know, you put up a post, I'd like to hear your top 10 ideas for saving money. And people will start creating content just answering your simple post like that. But, there's one fellow is a fly fishing devotee, and all he does is gets reviews. He writes people all over the country in emails, and he just says, you know, I'd like you to review your favorite fly fishing spot or this river or this tackle shop or things like that. And again, he himself is not a very good writer, but he gets his audience to write for him and create content for the blog. And his blog is, I think it's the second most popular fishing blog in the United States.
Now, by the way, Skip, the co-author of the book that you've done, How to Make Money Blogging from Home, I think in and of itself the title is critical, and it's so open. I'm looking at the table of contents for the book, and it's almost like you're sitting down with me and you're directing me step by step by step to accomplish something that I might not have thought I could do.
Right, absolutely, because, and that's the way we designed the book. The book's in two halves. I wrote the first half, which talks about what makes, how to be successful blogging, you know, how to find content, how to monetize it, different ways to make money with the blog. My co-author, Marcia Perry, is an expert on WordPress. WordPress is the most popular blogging software out there, and it's free software. I mean, you can, all you need is if you just, you know, you get a URL and a place to host, just a hosting account from any of the hosting companies can cost $5 or $6 a month, and you download the software for free, and you can have your first blog post up in about 1 hour. And what Marcia does in her part of the book is she takes all the technical mumbo jumbo out of it and just walks you through step by step, you know, how to go to this server, here's push this button to download the software, do X, Y, and Z to install the software, and you know, it's simple steps that even a child could follow. And then she takes you through the dashboard and shows you how to create your first blog post. And
now,
we literally have had people, I've got an email from people that have bought the book and had their blog homepage and their first post up within an hour or two of buying the book.
Well, I think what's critical, and it's doing that, but you know, it's one of the other things that you address in the book, getting people to find the blog. That I think is important. Somebody can write a blog. They can write a very powerful blog, interesting, provocative. It'll capture an audience. But if nobody sees the blog, it doesn't do them any good. So how do I get it out there? How do I promote it?
Well, right. And that's something I spend a great deal of time on. And the technical term for this you hear and you read on the internet is SEO, search engine optimization. That means creating content that and presenting that content in such a way that when someone is searching for something, the search engines will bring the people to your blog. And that's what we teach people how to do. And it's not that difficult. There's these SEO experts out there that will charge you $5,000 to go through your website or your blog and do all the little tricks and tips. But that's a total waste of money, because if you just create good content and present that content, learn, you know, and I give people some tools to help them determine the keywords and the keyword phrases that people search for. And once you determine those phrases, you work those phrases into your content. And believe me, Google will find you. I have I have four blogs up running now. One of my blogs has a page rank of 4 in Google. That's a 4 on a scale of 10, which is really good for a small independent blog. I mean, it's nothing like, you know, the Drudge Report, which is a 9 out of 10 or something, or the Huffington Post. Those are 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10. But with a page rank of 3 out of 10 or 4 out of 10, it's pretty easy to get enough traffic to monetize that to the tune of several thousand dollars a month. And I do it all by just, I just create content. I just think up, in my case, I write my own content. But I think up, you know, things to write about that people are interested in. And then I have a keyword tool that I mentioned in the book, and I show people where to get. And I just type in a few simple keywords, and then the tool tells me the keyword phrases that people use to search. And I just make sure I work those phrases into my blog post. And it's really that easy. And, I mean, that particular blog I'm talking about went from, which is easyauctiontools.com, went from, a page rank of nothing to 3 in about a month. And then now it kind of bounces between 3 and 4. I don't know if it's 3 or 4 today. But it was a 4 the last time I looked at it last week when I did my last post. And that blog does very well. I use that particular blog to make money with Amazon by reviewing Amazon. I review photographic products that are available on Amazon. And when people click on the link, and if they buy something from Amazon, I earn a commission.
Well, Skip, one of the things that I'm looking at here also, section 2 of the book, setting up the blog, I'm not techie at all. I'm not. I can use a computer, but when it comes down to getting sophisticated, I'm gone. But it's the blogging base. It's installing the WordPress, your dashboard, the WordPress themes, the post editor, the working with widgets, all of those things, the plugins, updating WordPress, etc. And all of those things that the novice would be frightened to death of if they didn't have a simple explanation of how to do it.
Right. And one thing the book will show you, well, you see it, you have it right in front of you, is that it's really easy to install. Installing a widget is something you can do. It takes you a couple minutes to find a widget, a couple minutes more to install it. It's nothing more than clicking a couple check boxes. And the widgets, the beautiful part about them, they do a lot of the technical work for you. I mean, that's the beauty of WordPress. WordPress is, if you can create a document in Microsoft Word, you have all the skills you need to install and operate WordPress and publish a blog.
That's the key. And I think that they're very important. You mentioned early on that people are going to talk about SEO and they're going to charge you an arm and a leg to get into all of these sophisticated things that you, in a lot of cases, you just don't need it. It's the same thing, the section 2 of the book, setting up the blog, setting up your blog. It's the same thing. Somebody's going to walk in and say, oh, I can do all this and I'll create the dashboard and the WordPress and I'll get your widgets. And by the time I have no idea what they're talking to and I'm going to write them a check for $5,000 and they're going to do all that stuff. When as simple as reading how to do it, hitting a couple of buttons, I've got it, don't I?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We actually have a fellow right here in the little small town I live in. He charges local businesses $1,000 to set up a website, and he uses WordPress. You know, WordPress is blogging software, but it can also look like a website. And he uses WordPress, and it literally takes him 30, 60, 90 minutes, something in that range, to set up the thing for them. And he comes back to them 3 or 4 days later and says, you know, and tells them, oh, I had to work hours on this. You really got a lot for your $1,000. And the people look at it, and they're blown away. Wow, I now have my own website for my restaurant, and it only cost me $1,000. And had they known, they could have done it for, you know, $10 themselves in about an hour.
And have I got a deal for you? Yeah, I got it loud and clear. Now, some of the topics which I think are going to be interesting, there's only a certain amount of topics that you can cover. You know, in today's world, most things are derivative. It's derived from something that we've seen before. So when we're going to blog, do we do our own unique perspective, the way we look at something to blog it? Or how do you find something different? How do you find something that somebody's going to want to read?
Well, it's all about, one of my early chapters in there is about finding a niche. And I go through, you know, I explain what niches are and find them and how to drill down to them. And, you know, that's the real key. I mean, your chances of having a blog, I mean, if you wanted a blog that was going to be as famous, you know, as some of the big ones that have millions of readers, then you almost need a name or something. You know, you need to be a celebrity, or you have to already have a name or a following or something like that. The number of blogs out there that got started, let me give you an example now. It's sure. You know, Arianna Huffington just sold her Huffington Post to, was it AOL or ABC or somebody like that, for $300 million.
It was AOL, yeah.
Yeah, and all Arianna Huffington did, she started this blog, and then she invited other bloggers, other very well-known bloggers, to post and write content for her blog. So she has almost no content on that blog of her own, or even of the people that work for her. And she built a blog by getting other people to blog for her, essentially, and turned it into a $300 million empire. So, you can do that, but what my book is really about is the person that, you know, they have a passion for something like quilting or fly fishing or, God knows what, any kind of sort of craft, art, interest, history, you know, maybe they're history buffs, so like a Civil War buff or something like that. And I just tell them to take that interest, take that passion, and start creating content and finding content to add to a blog. And if you're, you know, a niche needs to be small enough that you're not competing with the really big guys and gals of the world, but it needs to be large enough that there's, you know, maybe 250,000, 500,000, 1,000,000 people out there that are potential readers for the blog. So, you know, one of the examples I give in the book is I've always been interested in photography, and of course there's all these big photography websites, and you trying to get traction in photography is really tough because, you know, almost any photographic term that you type into a computer, you know, your little blog's going to be on page 73 of Google. But I just kept drilling down, and I found a niche that wasn't being served was underwater digital cameras. So I created a blog.underwaterdigitalcameras.com, and I review underwater digital cameras. And again, the reviews are tied to products on Amazon, and someone reads the review, they click on the link. If they buy the product from Amazon, I earn a commission. And, you know, I was just finding that little niche. I just found when I started searching all these photographic terms that no one was really paying attention to underwater digital cameras.
Now, by the way, it's that same American something that we always have and we always will. It's that thought, that just that certain something that's a little different than everybody else. You take advantage of it, and we still live in the land of opportunity, and you can do the job. Skip McGrath, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, well, it's just my name, skipmcgrath.com. That's SKIPMCGRATH, skipmcgrath.com.
Wonderful.
And,
hey, Skip,
there you can link all my blogs.
Wonderful. Hey, Skip, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure, Michael. I hope we can do this again someday.
Oh, absolutely. Skip, take care. Good night.
Good night.
Splish splash, I jump back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing, reeling with the feeling, moving and a grooving, rocking and a rolling. Bing bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Golly, Miss Molly, was I even there too? Well, splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dance.
And if there's a subject you'd like to hear addressed on the show or someone you'd like to hear interviewed, contact Radio Susie. You can find her on the homepage of the website. And as a matter of fact, if you want to find our guest on the guest page on the website, you can find them in case you missed the name of a book, a website, or any other contact information. Welcome back, Patricia Bragg, back with us. Patricia, hi, how are you?
healthy and fit.
Oh, and this is there any other way to be? I'm so glad you're here. You're, by the way, all of the things that you've done over the years with help, I'm sure a lot of people who know who you are and know the things that you've done. The key here is that everything that you've done works. And there's, and I'm a product of that. You know, I've used a lot of the stuff that you have. And if we take care of ourselves and we make sure that we're healthy, then all of a sudden you don't have to go to the doctor for the heart problems and the cholesterol and everything else that goes along with it. I'm going to take you all the way back to the very beginning. What was it that caused you to look in, to make your life all about health?
Well, I tell you what, I was just blessed with the right parents, and they knew right from wrong. In other words, they knew how to live a healthy, natural life. I had Blue Cross insurance for 35 years and never used it once.
And what I love every second of
that. And Blue Cross insurance made money on me. I never used it once. But you know, nowadays when you have employees, you have to give them insurance. And so we always had Blue Cross, which was very popular in California.
Oh, sure. No, I remember, by the way, I remember it well, but even the topic or the title of your book, Brag Healthy Lifestyle, Vital Living to 120 Years Old, Body Purification, you can get the toxicless diet. Now, I can't say that 10 times, Patricia, but I can try. And there's a healing system that goes along with it also.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Let me tell you something. It's this. The Brag Healthy Lifestyle is this. You are what you eat and what you drink. And remember, when you put it in your fuel tank, open your mouth. There it is, round, just like a fuel tank. And what you put in there with your knife and fork and spoon is going to walk and talk tomorrow because it becomes your fuel. So just remember, everything you're putting in your fuel tank, your mouth, remember, it's either going to bring you health or could bring you sickness, constipation, headaches, stomach aches, a lot of problems. So start eating healthy and put it to the test. Now, this is it. You are what you eat, what you drink, what you breathe. Now, we're breathing machines. It's so very important that I want people not to smoke and don't even be around people that smoke. And if someone wants to come to your house and smoke, have them step outside, but close the windows where they're standing outside because smoke might blow in. You see, your lungs, oh, wow, oxygen is the invisible staff of life, Michael. Do you realize that? And most Americans are shallow breathers, and that's why they don't have any energy.
I want to talk about food for a minute because, you know, you're so spot on when it comes to that. Food in and of itself, is nothing more than a chemical, is it, once you chew it up?
Well, what it is, it's filled with vitamins, minerals, and nutrients. And see, your first step of digestion is in the mouth. And you see, we just don't have teeth to look pretty. They are our food choppers because your stomach has no teeth. And so, therefore, people bring their little children to me. Oh, why does Johnny have tummy ache all the time? And I said, listen, Johnny, do you like to chew your food? And he says, well, I don't even think about it. I just maybe swish it around and swallow it. I said, listen, you start chewing your food at 20, 30 good chops with everything you put in your mouth, okay? And I bet you that tummy ache is going to go away. You see?
By the way, what is so important about, and by the way, I've got that loud and clear. But organic food, what is so critically important about organic food?
Well, my dear, when you're eating food that came from a soil, actually almost like a dead soil, it has artificial fertilizers, chemical sprays on the food, it has GMO, foods. Genetically engineered foods are very bad. You want to go organic. Don't panic. You don't want to be eating food that has combined with rats, and that's what they're doing with genetically engineered foods. They mix the cells with rats and different things, so they figure the rats won't eat the grains. because it has some of their own genes in it. It's the most. It's terrible. It's. I don't even want to go into it. But I'm just telling you that go organic. Don't panic. You don't want to have pesticides, chemical fertilizers, and the soil is living. You can put your hands down in my garden, and it's loaded with earthworms. Earthworms are man's best friend of the soil. It's tilling the soil night and day.
Just now, by the way, vinegar is so critical to people's health, they don't get it. And I've got to tell you that every time I do the, you know, the, your apple cider vinegar, life is completely different. And it's just very simple to do. You take the vinegar and it cleans your body out.
It's wonderful. Well, Hippocrates, the father of medicine, used it in 400 B.C., to detox and cleanse and heal his patients. He didn't have drugstores and pills and all the chemical medicines that they have nowadays. Not at all. He did everything naturally. Oh, my. And, you know, I've made over 30 trips around the world. I've been in countries they don't even know what a drugstore is or a TV. What do you think of that? Or a radio. And I've been in countries where they don't even have shoes. And guess what? They have beautiful feet, strong feet. I was nutritionist to Dr. Scholl, the foot doctor, and I go, I'm standing here right now exercising, standing up, looking out at the ocean here in Santa Barbara, and I'm barefooted. And as soon as I walk into my house, off come the shoes. And around in my offices, I go barefooted.
Let me come up with something, bring up something, because I think it's extremely important. An example, and it was a horrible loss, but an example of someone who followed everything that you talk about, Jack LaLanne, who recently passed away.
Oh, my dear. He was a week in loss. I was with him at Christmas holidays. He was almost 97. Oh, my gosh, a tower of strength. He did everything he preached. He lived it, loved it, and preached health and fitness. Oh. And guess what? He was in L.A., and L.A. is one of the worst riddled cities for smog in the United States. And he was down there for a week after Christmas, and he got pneumonia. Now, pneumonia is one of the worst things, but it's a true proven fact. They just came out that smog coats the arteries and not only coats the lungs. And so here he was going on 97, getting pneumonia. And my golly, he was down there for a week. Everybody wanted to see him, and there were party time after Christmas and New Year's and all of that. And then they came back to his home where the air is fresh right on the ocean. And my golly, of course, he got pneumonia in L.A., brought him back, and he was gone in a matter of half hour.
I mean, this is the same man who swam from...
Oh, my dear, are you kidding? Alcatraz to San Francisco. Yeah. He went from Catalina to Long Beach. Oh, my golly, dear. He's won world records in doing push-ups. He was amazing. But I want you to know that he has millions of people that he got exercising through the years. My father took him when he was a puny, sickly little boy, 15. And guess what? He said, Patricia, if I hadn't heard your dad that one night in Oakland, California, I would have been dead at 17. And he listened to my father one lecture, and it changed his life. And he was a dynamo. And he inspired millions of children and mothers and people of all ages to exercise. And he was on TV, oh, my gosh, over 40-some years. Five days a week.
He, like you, walked the walk. And I think that's what's really critical. If more people would start paying attention to their health, naturally paying attention to their health, take a look at the things that you can eat that are not going to give you a problem, you live longer and you feel better.
Of course. Now, let me tell you the rest of the Bragg Healthy Lifestyle. You are what you eat, what you drink, what you breathe. That means no smoke, no pot. Okay, listen to this. What you eat and drink, walks and talks tomorrow. You can't live without oxygen, the invisible staff of life. And, everything you say, your words are living. If you get in fights and one thing or another, your blood pressure goes up, you're going to have a heart attack. Before you talk, put it to the test. Is it good? Is it kind? Is it necessary? All right. And if it's not good, don't say it. Okay, next you are, guess what? What you think. Now, if you think negative, dirty thoughts, Michael, oh, your life is going to be miserable. So remember, what you put in up in your brain, your computer, wow, it becomes you. So put beautiful, wonderful thoughts, positive thoughts, and next with what you do in your life. You have 640 muscles, and if you don't use them, you lose them. Look at all these people walking around obese. Oh, they overfueled their body. They didn't exercise. Listen, I exercise. I love it. Right now, I'm going to do the windmill exercise. I'm taking my right arm, and I'm moving it all around, just like a windmill. Wow, and your energy, now I'm doing my left arm, and your energy comes right up. I have millions of people doing this, Michael, all over America. What do you think of that? During
their
break,
they go
beautiful. Outside and do the windmill exercises. They do stationary jogging. Instead of sitting down watching TV, woo, get up and exercise while you're watching that telly. They can go to my web, brag.com, and they can hear me lecture. They can, by the way, I'll put this show up, too, that I'm going to be on with you right now. You see,
wonderful.
And I appreciate you having me on, because it's important that we share the message of health, Michael.
No, there's no question about it, and I really believe in my heart of hearts that if you just take that little extra time and do a little bit of extra exercising or any at all, but which most people don't do, and you eat the right foods and you learn about foods and how it affects your body, not only does it affect your body, you'll say it in a different way. Patricia,
yes.
It affects the way your emotions, the way you think, the way you behave, how you perform on the job, in a relationship, all has to do with what you take in.
Michael, listen, do you know, when Dad taught me when I was a little girl, before you speak, Patricia, is it good, is it kind, is it necessary? I didn't get in fights. I've never said any dirty words. I mean, we have had a peaceful house. We say our prayers before we go to bed at night. We're Christians. We love the Lord. And I love all religions and all people. I don't like wars and killings and greed and meanness. And I wish we didn't have these wars, and I hope everything gets worked out in Washington. And I send them my prayers, Michael.
No, no
and question. I know that you know a lot what's going on, and I just feel that the world needs to be cleaned up.
I want to go back to the 50s. It wasn't quite as bad as it is today, but I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen. But you're right. It has. And when you talk about, I talk about, anybody talks about, that you are what you think. And the key is, if you can get everybody thinking the same way, a lot of this junk stops. And there are those people at the top that cause the problem. It's not the average person that that lives their life that really is responsible for a lot of this. But they get sucked up into this ideology and these philosophies that end up hurting somebody else. So you're right. It's a mindset. It's a thought. And it all has to do. And again, what you eat. Look at some of these dictators running around out there. If they, you tell me that Gaddafi looks healthy, I don't think so.
No. I tell you, they're probably big meat eaters. A lot of people that are high on meat can be very mean, and they can be very vicious. And I feel that vegetarians are much sweeter, healthier people. By the way, Bill Clinton has become a vegan. And he's taken off over 30 pounds. And we have a lot of top stars that are becoming vegans. And I've been nutritionist to Katy Perry since she was 12. Mm. And she loves our vinegar drink. She keeps her voice strong. The Bragg vinegar drink now, Michael, is in all health food stores nationwide.
Well, Patricia, we're starting to run out of time. One more time, please, with your website.
All right, I'd love people to go to it, bragg.com, and you can get our things in health food stores and supermarkets, the Bragg Aminos, Bragg Apple Cider Vinegar, and I send my love to the world and everybody in America, and I hope everything works out, that we bring peace to the world.
Wonderful. Hey, Patricia, thank you so much for joining us, and I always appreciate it when you're on.
Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
My good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Let me end the show, this segment, with the teacher. Her name was Mrs. Thompson, and she stood in front of her fifth grade class on the very first day of school. She told the children a lie. Like most teachers, she looked at her students and said she loved them all. She loved them all the same. But that was impossible because there in the front row, slumped in his seat, was a little boy by the name of Teddy Stoddard. Mrs. Thompson had watched Teddy the year before and noticed that he didn't play well with the other kids. His clothes were messy and he constantly needed a bath. And Teddy could be very unpleasant. Now, it got to the point where Mrs. Thompson would actually take delight in marking his papers with a broad red pen, marking bold X's, and then putting a big F at the top of the papers. And at the school where Mrs. Thompson taught, she was required to review each children's past records, and she put Teddy's off until the very last. However, when she reviewed his file, she was in for a surprise. Teddy's first grade teacher said Teddy's a bright child with a ready laugh. He does his work neatly. He's got good manners. He's a joy to be around, and he enjoys his fellow students. Second grade teacher wrote, Teddy's an excellent student, well-liked by his classmates, but he's troubled because his mother has a terminal illness and life at home must be a struggle. Third grade teacher wrote, his mother's death has been hard on him. He tries to do his best, but his father doesn't show much interest in his home life, and pretty soon that's going to affect him if steps aren't taken. Teddy's fourth grade teacher wrote, Teddy's withdrawn, doesn't show much interest in school, and he doesn't have many friends, and he sometimes sleeps in class. By now, Mrs. Thompson realized the problem, and she was ashamed of herself. She felt even worse when her students brought her Christmas presents wrapped in beautiful ribbons and bright paper, except for Teddy's. His present was clumsily wrapped in a heavy brown paper bag that he got from the grocery store. Mrs. Thompson took pains to open it in the middle of the other presents, and some of the children started to laugh when they found a rhinestone bracelet with some of the stones missing and a bottle that was one quarter full of perfume. But she stifled the children's laughter, and she explained how pretty the bracelet was. Putting it on, and she dabbed some of the perfume on her wrist, Teddy Stoddard stayed after school that day just long enough to say, Mrs. Thompson, today you smell just like my mom used to. And after the children left, she cried for at least an hour. And on that very day, she quit teaching and reading and writing and arithmetic. Instead, she began teaching children. And Mrs. Thompson paid particular attention to Teddy, and as she worked with him, his mind seemed to come alive. And the more she encouraged him, the faster he responded. And at the end of the year, Teddy had become one of the smartest children in that class. Despite her lie that she would love all the children the same, Teddy became one of her teacher's pets. Now, a year later, she found a note under her door from Teddy telling her that she was still the best teacher that he ever had in his whole life. 6 years went by before she got another note from Teddy. And then he wrote he just finished high school, third in his class, and she was still the best teacher that he'd ever had in his entire life. Now, 4 years after that, she got another letter saying that while things had been rough at times, he'd stayed in school. He stuck it out, and he'd soon graduate from college with the highest of honors. And he assured Mrs. Thompson that she was one of the best and favorite teachers that he had in his entire life. 4 more years passed, and yet another letter came. This time he explained that he got a bachelor's degree and he decided to go a little farther. The letter explained that she was still the best and the favorite teacher that he ever had. But now the signature was a little longer. It was a little different. The letter was signed Theodore F. Stoddard, M.D. Now, the story doesn't end here. You see, that was just another letter that spring, Teddy said he'd met a girl and was going to get married. He explained that his father had died a couple of years before, and he was wondering if Mrs. Thompson might agree to sit in place at the wedding where usually that was reserved for the mother of the groom. And, of course, Mrs. Stoddard did. And guess what? She wore the bracelet, the one that several rhinestones missing, that one. And she made sure that she was wearing perfume that Teddy remembered that his mother was wearing on her last Christmas together. And they hugged each other, and Dr. Stoddard whispered in Mrs. Thompson's ear, "Thank you, Mrs. Thompson. Thank you for believing in me. Thank you for so much for making me feel important and showing me that I could make a difference." And Mrs. Thompson, with tears in her eyes, whispered back. She said, "Teddy, you got it all wrong. You were the one who taught me that I could make a difference. I didn't know how to teach until I met you." So go out and warm somebody's heart today and pass it along.
Go to those fabulous places where we long to be.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.